morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, May 12, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Jake Wallner.
Coming up on the KBOO Morning News. Salmon arrive at the Bonneville Dam 3 weeks late, worrying wildlife managers and fishermen alike. A lawsuit filed in Arizona this week asks that voter identification requirements be declared unconstitutional. And Cheney, let's flip the importance of Turkey's role in energy supply distribution. Today's Portland area weather, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs around 65. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s.
Several auto shops in Salem will replace mercury switches in cars for free. Until last week, Bob Anderson had a stockpile of mercury at his auto repair shop. It didn't worry Anderson. He purposely has collected the toxin to get it out of the environment. In the past 4 years, Anderson has collected more than 2,700 of the pellet-sized switches. Statewide, almost 9,000 switches have been replaced. Mechanics at the shops replace the mercury switch with a non-toxic switch that uses a steel roller instead. The mercury switch was used in many cars until 2003 to light the underhood and trunk areas. A gram of mercury is toxic enough to make all the fish in a 20-acre lake unsafe to eat, said Laura Weiss of the nonprofit Oregon Environmental Council. The problem with mercury switches in cars is that they could be crushed with the car at a junkyard, then fired up in a furnace where the mercury ends up in the air. From there, it likely will settle in water and be taken up by microorganisms that are eaten by fish. Mercury builds up as it works its way up the food chain, Weiss said. The mercury in the auto switches is collected at hazardous facilities by Clean Harbor Environmental Services.
McCormick and Schmick's, the operator of about 60 upscale seafood restaurants nationwide, was accused in a federal court suit yesterday of discriminating against black employees and applicants. A black waitress employed at the company and a black bartender denied employment accused the chain of passing over blacks for promotions or employment. The racial discrimination suit also said black workers were given lower-paying jobs and shorter or less desirable shifts than white counterparts. A spokesman for the restaurant chain based in Portland said the company does not discriminate.
Spring Chinook salmon are finally moving up the Columbia River at Bonneville Dam, making their latest run on record. The three-week delay is a mystery to wildlife managers, and lower-than-expected numbers in the run have some fishermen thinking the fishing season will not reopen. A spring Chinook run typically peaks in mid-April, but it wasn't until last week that sustained numbers of salmon were counted as they went through the ladder at Bonneville Dam, according to the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Departments. Fishing industry groups said that while they have written off the season, they are still concerned about the early trends in low and late salmon runs. This is the second consecutive year the run has been late. Fish and wildlife officials said they don't know if the pattern will repeat next year. Based on early season fishing, wildlife officials said they know the spring Chinook were entering the Columbia from the Pacific Ocean at their usual time, but the fish seemed to hang around the 40 miles between the Interstate 5 bridge at Portland and the Bonneville Dam. The area is heavy with predatory animals such as sea lions, but fish officials didn't know what the effect that has on the count.
For years, timber companies and the government have debated environmental groups and Indian tribes over whether Washington's timber industry should get 50 years of protection from Endangered Species Act prosecutions for harming salmon. The debate was required under a federal law meant to give the public a chance to speak out before the government makes a major environmental decision. But now environmentalists are charging that the whole thing looks as if it was a foregone conclusion. That flies in the face of a federal law designed to give close environmental review to federal actions. The proposed 50-year exemption would cover 9 million acres of private forest land, about one-fifth of Washington. It would be the second largest such deal in the country. In addition to protecting timber companies, it would give legal shelter to the state, which permits logging that can harm the fish in many ways, such as allowing streams to heat up too much to be healthy for salmon. In return, timber companies promise to leave trees standing alongside some streams, to fix forest roads that smother streams in clouds of dirt, and open up salmon spawning habitat previously blocked by roads. This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Grays Harbor County, Washington, will be home to an enormous biodiesel production plant under an agreement involving Seattle-based Imperium Renewables. The plant will produce 100 million gallons of biodiesel a year. Last year, national biodiesel production was just 75 million gallons. According to the Missouri-based National Biodiesel Board, by the end of the year, that number is expected to double. Biodiesel is a generic term for any clean-burning alternative fuel made from domestic renewable resources. Soybean oil is the primary component for biodiesels now made in the United States. The $40 million plant would create 250 to 350 jobs during its construction and is expected to create 50 permanent jobs once it is up and running. It was welcome news to a hard-pressed region that has had major unemployment after fishing and timber have declined. This year, lawmakers made Washington only the second state in the country with biofuel and biodiesel mandates to be implemented by December 2008. Budget writers also designated millions of dollars for biofuel low-interest loan programs to plant the seeds for the production, refining, and infrastructure for alternative fuels.
In King County, Washington, an abuse of public trust is occurring time and again at the expense of taxpayers. Bad cops have and will continue to cost the state and county millions of dollars as publicly bankrolled salaries and taxpayer-subsidized pensions reap lucrative rewards for rogue cops. A Seattle Post-Intelligencer examination of state pension and payroll records of 8 King County sheriff's deputies shows example after example of how such problem officers continue drawing salaries and earning service credits for years. This fattened retirements for these men, 6 of whom engaged in acts of misconduct so serious they could have been fired years earlier. While it's not easy to fire deputies, the sheriff's rule book also says the kind of misconduct committed by officers cited in this story can or will result in dismissal. Along with millions in work and retirement pay, taxpayers are paid hundreds of thousands more in settlements of legal claims brought by alleged victims of 4 of the deputies. These deputies are able to harvest publicly afforded spoils despite questionable, even criminal, employment records.
A condemned inmate in Ohio asked prison officials to find another way to execute him as they struggled to administer a lethal injection after an intravenous line failed, prison records show. Joseph Clark asked during the 90-minute delay, "Can you just give me something by mouth to end this?" The May 2nd execution was plagued with problems from the beginning, when team members struggled for several minutes to find a vein. After inserting a shunt in Clark's arm, the vein collapsed, leading Clark to push himself up and say, "It don't work." The team then attached a shunt to Clark's other arm, but apparently tried to administer the lethal drugs through the first shunt by mistake. The execution happened amid a growing debate about lethal injection, with many death row inmates claiming their deaths could constitute cruel and unusual punishment, either because the drugs or because the procedure is not handled by specially trained medical personnel. The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction is reviewing the execution, but does not believe its procedures were flawed.
A broad coalition of organizations has collected over 40,000 signatures on a petition opposing a U.S. attack on Iran. Cindy Sheehan plans to lead the delivery of the petition and signatures to the White House on Thursday, May 18th, in cooperation with a pray-in in Lafayette Square Park organized by the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Following remarks by these speakers and delivery of the petition, along with boxes of signatures and comments to the White House, Ray McGovern, U.S. Army veteran and retired 27-year CIA analyst, will lead a march through downtown Washington, D.C., to the home of Donald Rumsfeld, where protesters will gather. This from the BuzzFlash website.
A lawsuit filed this week in federal court asked that voter identification and registration requirements imposed under the 2004 election law known as Proposition 200 be declared unconstitutional. Several Latino advocacy groups brought the suit on behalf of a handful of Arizona residents. The lawsuit says that Proposition 200, approved by voters, should be stricken down because of its dampening effect on minority voting. It's unclear when the court will decide the issue, but the plaintiffs are seeking a temporary restraining order against Proposition 200, potentially putting the measure on ice for next week's local elections. Longer term, the suit asks for a court injunction against the measure. Critics say the measure's requirements for proof of citizenship when registering to vote and proper identification when voting have a disproportionate impact on minority voters, who are less likely to meet the requirements. Advocates supported the measure as a way to keep undocumented immigrants from the ballot box and reduce voter fraud, but critics have called the fraud fear overblown and unsubstantiated and have maintained that the measure would disenfranchise legal residents who lack proper identification. In many cases, that means minorities and the poor.
Prosecutors recommended a 2-year prison sentence for a former Republican National Committee official convicted in an Election Day phone-jamming plot against New Hampshire Democrats. James Tobin of Bangor, Maine, was found guilty on 2 telephone harassment charges. He faces up to 7 years in prison and a $500,000 fine. Tobin stepped down as New England chairman of President Bush's re-election campaign in 2004 when Democrats accused him of playing a role in the phone scheme on Election Day 2002. At the time of the jamming, Tobin was serving as regional political director for the RNC.
Citing anonymous sources, USA Today wrote this week that AT&T Incorporated, Bell South Corporation, and Verizon Communications all turned over their customers' phone records to the NSA not long after the terrorist attacks. The paper noted that Quest Communications International refused to give customer records to the NSA because of privacy and legal concerns. Bell South did not respond immediately to requests for comment. President Bush gave brief remarks yesterday regarding the article. He said he did authorize the NSA to intercept the international communications of people with known links to Al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations. But, he said, the government does not listen to domestic phone calls without court approval. Congressional members were furious over the matter.
The White House continued to stand by its nominee for CIA Director, General Michael Hayden, amid new controversy over the surveillance programs he piloted as head of the National Security Agency. Hayden was to meet with senators later today, his 5th day of face-to-face sessions on Capitol Hill since a Monday morning breakfast with Senate Intelligence Chairman Pat Roberts. Lawmakers have been demanding information from the Bush administration about the NSA's efforts to collect records on millions of Americans' phone calls. The disclosure reported in yesterday's edition of USA Today could complicate President Bush's bid to win Hayden's confirmation. It also renewed concerns about civil liberties and questions about the legal underpinnings of the government's actions.
President Bush said yesterday that he envisioned the Gulf Coast whole again, even as he spoke in a stadium still under repair from Hurricane Katrina's fury more than 8 months ago. But the president has threatened to veto a bill that funds the Iraq and Afghanistan wars because it also includes almost $30 billion for hurricane rebuilding. Bush did not ask for the latter spending. The House of Representatives has passed legislation in line with Bush's request. The two chambers will try to work out their differences by the end of the month. Many residents, especially in New Orleans, have been frustrated by the slow pace of recovery and political fallout from the federal government's botched response to Katrina has contributed to the lowest poll numbers of Bush's presidency. With the new Atlantic hurricane season 3 weeks away, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has made changes and officials say they are ready. Bush did not mention the government's much-maligned disaster agency.
As Washington seeks to overhaul America's broken immigration policies, Congress is considering putting many more such barriers along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border, which already has 83 miles of fences. A bill that cleared the House in December would put fences at immigrant and drug smuggling corridors in all 4 southern border states. At an estimated cost of $2.5 billion, the fences would cover 850 miles of border, though it would not be one continuous wall. The gaps would be policed the way many remote areas of the border are already guarded now. Motion sensors, cameras, unmanned drone aircraft and border patrol agents. Immigrant rights groups say fences waste taxpayer money because would-be border crossers who are desperate to earn a better living in America will always find a way around or through barriers, as evidenced by the lower sections of the fence in Douglas County where rods have had to be welded into place to patch up breaches. But the Border Patrol says fences slow down immigrants so authorities can have enough time to respond to those who try to come across. That, in turn, frees up other agents to focus on remote areas where they already use aircraft and ground sensors.
The Pentagon is looking at ways the military can help provide more security along the U.S. southern border, once again drawing the nation's armed forces into a politically sensitive domestic role. The Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense asked officials this week to come up with options for the use of military resources and troops, particularly the National Guard along the border with Mexico. The officials who requested anonymity because the matter has not been made public said there are no details yet on a defense strategy. The request comes as some southern lawmakers met this week with White House strategist Karl Rove for a discussion that included making greater use of National Guard troops to shore up border control. The Senate is poised to pass legislation this month that would call for additional border security, a new guest worker program, and provisions opening the way to eventual citizenship for many of the estimated 11 million legal immigrants in the country.
Atmospheric circulation over the Pacific Ocean has weakened significantly during the past century, and scientists say the most likely explanation for the shift is human-induced climate change. Although few people have heard of the vast loop of winds known as the Walker Circulation, its effects are felt worldwide. These include El Niño episodes, seasonal Asian monsoons, and the upwelling of cold water from the deep ocean that nourishes marine food chains. In the current issue of the British journal Nature, Vecchia and a team of scientists report that the Walker circulation has weakened by 3.5% since the mid-1800s. Most of that weakening has occurred in the past 50 years. Many theoretical studies have suggested that such a change would occur if the world is warming, but the latest research is the first to show that it is actually taking place. One hint of what may be in store lies in the natural shift in weather patterns known as El Niño, which brings devastating droughts to Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and Australia, violent winter storms to the U.S. West Coast, and a sharp decline in fishing along the Pacific coast of South America.
Japan's government is pushing for the passage of anti-conspiracy law, with potentially far-reaching consequences. The conspiracy or collusion law appears headed for passage in the Diet as soon as next week. In its present form, it could result in Japanese citizens being detained or punished for merely agreeing with one another. In combination with another statute that permits detention without charge, the new law could have a chilling effect on civil liberties, including freedoms of speech and assembly and the right to organize. Simply belonging to a group or being in the same room where certain conversations take place could make a person subject to the new law. No crime need be actually carried out for the police to detain suspects. Failing to report overheard conspiratorial talk could be construed collusion.
Corruption charges against ailing former Indonesian dictator Suharto have been dropped, and he's a free man, said Indonesia's Attorney General. Suharto remained hospitalized in Jakarta after undergoing colon surgery last weekend. Doctors say he's in frail health, which may have influenced the decision to drop the charges. Just hours earlier, Indonesia's president said he'd abandoned a plan to drop corruption charges, citing what he said was public anger over the proposed move.
In addition to harshly criticizing Russia recently, Dick Cheney accidentally highlighted a relatively unheralded goal of U.S. foreign policy. That is to turn Turkey into a conduit for energy supplies that bypass the control of President Putin and the majority state-owned Russian gas giant Gazprom. It is a role Turkey, already a NATO member, is embracing, albeit with considerable anxiety and hesitation. It dovetails with Turkey's ambition to become the first predominantly Islamic country to be a full EU member. The Europeans, frightened off by Russia's abrupt closure of gas supplies to Ukraine earlier this year, are seeking to reduce their dependence on Gazprom, which already supplies a quarter of the EU's natural gas. This is one of two overriding reasons why Turks seek their country as an indispensable asset for Europe, its potential as a transit country for energy supplies between Central Asia, a growing rival to Russia and the EU. The other is its young population, which can help to provide solutions to Europe's aging crisis. There are 9 current and planned gas pipelines. There are the same number of oil pipelines. This is the pet project of the U.S. State Department in its renewed power struggle, in both senses, with the Kremlin. U.S. Special Forces have trained 2,000 Georgian soldiers in anti-terrorist techniques to protect the pipeline, which would be a target if America ever engaged militarily with Iran.
Hundreds of Kurds had to flee their homes in the mountain village of Raqqa, Iraq, when artillery shells came whistling down on them from Iran earlier this month. In Turkey, meanwhile, armored personnel carriers and tanks rumble along its remote border with Iraq's Kurdish zone. Turkey has sent tens of thousands of fresh soldiers in the past few weeks to beef up an already formidable force along the Iraqi border. The Kurdish provinces of northern Iraq were the country's most stable and prosperous area, but to neighboring Iran and Turkey, they're a support base for the Kurdish militants in their own countries. So, Iran and Turkey are sending troops, tanks, and artillery to the frontier to seal off the borders and send a message. If the U.S.-backed Iraqi government doesn't clamp down on Turkish guerrillas who use Iraq as a base, they'll do it themselves. That's left the United States in a quandary. If U.S. forces take action, they risk alienating Iraqi Kurds, the most pro-American group in the region. And if they don't, they risk increased tensions and possibly worse with two powerful rivals.
Violence in Sri Lanka has escalated sharply as a Navy patrol boat was sunk by Tamil Tiger rebels and the military carried out retaliatory attacks on rebel ships and bases, this according to The Guardian. At least 15 Sri Lankan Navy sailors were missing after the patrol boat's sinking, which happened as the boat's crew tried to defend a troop carrier with more than 700 soldiers on board off the country's northern coast. A naval spokesman said the patrol boat had been in a convoy escorting the carrier when it was attacked by the Liberation Tigers of Tamil. A spokesman for the Tamil Tigers said the Air Force had also bombed areas near rebel headquarters in the north of the country. European monitors said the rebel action was a gross violation of the ceasefire agreed in 2002. Elsewhere in Sri Lanka, 2 civilians died and at least 3 other people were wounded in 3 attacks blamed on separatist rebels in the north and northeast.
Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is due to leave for Washington in 2 weeks' time and hold a summit with President Bush. The two leaders are set to meet in a bid to formulate a uniform stance on the Iranian nuclear threat and Hamas rule in the Palestinian Authority. The Prime Minister will also attempt to ascertain the administration's standpoint on the issue of the planned Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Olmert is scheduled to be in Washington for 4 days. Diplomatic officials in Jerusalem stressed that the main purpose of the visit is to hold an introduction between Olmert and the senior American officials and to confirm both countries see eye to eye on several issues. Olmert will also seek to emphasize during the visit the need for international action against the Iranian nuclear plan and the Hamas government, which threaten the region. Olmert will point to the link between the two subjects. The Prime Minister will make clear to his American counterparts that Tehran's nuclear project and the country's threats to destroy Israel represent a threat to the entire Western world. This from Ynet and Israeli news services.
BuzzFlash has a news flash for Americans. Remember that country we invaded right after 9/11? You know, the one that actually had a connection to terrorists? Turns out that the Bush administration now says that the Taliban are not terrorists. Sure, the Taliban may be attacking U.S., Canadian, and British forces, but they still don't count as terrorists, according to President Bush. As the Christian Science Monitor reports, when the U.S. State Department issued its annual country reports on terrorism, it listed numerous state sponsors of terrorism, like Iran, and groups it considers foreign terrorist organizations, like Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah. Conspicuously absent from the list, however, was the Taliban. In an article entitled Terrorism Dubious A-List, the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations reports that the religious extremist organization has never been listed as a terrorist group. despite the fact that during its six-year rule in Afghanistan, it provided safe haven for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and currently is staging terrorist attacks against coalition forces and waging a national campaign of intimidation and fear.
Egyptian police have clashed violently with protesters rallying in support of two senior judges who've been spearheading calls for reform. The BBC says some people were beaten up and others detained as they tried to reach a courthouse where the judges faced disciplinary action. Hashem Batwashi and Mahmoud Mekki faced dismissal for criticizing last year's presidential election as fraudulent. The two men refused to enter the court yesterday when security services prevented many members of the defense team from coming in with them. The Egyptian authorities have been facing an unprecedented challenge from the judiciary. It will become a rallying point for all those pressing for reform. The judges want new legislation guaranteeing their independence, and they've been speaking out against election rigging. Large sections of central Cairo were sealed off by thousands of riot police armed with sticks and shields. This from the BBC.
Many hundreds of residents of the Somali capital Mogadishu are fleeing their homes as warlords and Islamist militias battle for control, this according to the BBC. The Alliance of Warlords has accused the Islamists of indiscriminate shelling designed to provoke fear among the civilian population. The fighting between the Islamists and a group of warlords has killed some 120 people in the worst clashes for years. Many Somalis accuse the U.S. of backing the Alliance of Warlords. A United Nations team says the Islamist Alliance had gained ground since the fighting began last Sunday. Most of those killed in the fighting are civilians caught in crossfire or hit by stray bullets or shells, he says. The rival groups used heavy artillery and mortar rounds as the fighting raged overnight, with many buildings destroyed.
Four bombs exploded in Ethiopia's capital today, killing two people and wounding 21. One of the bombs exploded outside two cafes in Addis Ababa's busy Mercato district, killing two people and injuring seven others, five of them seriously. A federal police spokesman said the blasts were the work of an organization trying to discredit the government. The first blast occurred at 4:50 a.m. in one of Addis Ababa's main plazas and damaged an Ethiopian Airlines office, but caused no injuries. The next three blasts occurred between 9:20 and 9:40. One damaged the headquarters of the city's electricity company, injuring seven. The next blast blew out the front of a city bus, also injuring seven. The final blast was at the cafe. There are two rebel groups fighting for autonomy in two Ethiopian regions, and small bombs have become a common occurrence in the capital, but rarely cause injuries or significant damage. No group has claimed responsibility for any of these bombings.
Three foreign oil workers have been kidnapped in the southern Nigerian city of Port Harcourt a day after a U.S. expatriate was shot dead, according to the BBC. The group, who worked for Italian firm AGIP, were seized in a car, put on a boat, and taken into creeks, police say. MEND, a Nigerian militant group campaigning against the oil industry, said it had no hand in the kidnappings or the killing. It has kidnapped foreign oil workers before in its quest for more local control of the region's oil wealth. Nigerian police spokesman Haz Iwendi said it appeared the kidnapping was the result of a dispute over money between a local community and AGIP. The upsurge of attacks on foreign oil interests has cut the country's oil production by 20%. Last month, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta renewed its threat to continue oil installation attacks. It said the offer of thousands more jobs and a new motorway from the President Olusegun Obasanjo did not address their demands for more local control of oil wealth and demilitarization. That was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, May 12, 2006. Today, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs around 65. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Saturday, mostly sunny, highs 70 to 75, lows in the upper 30s to mid-40s. Sunday, sunny, highs 75 to 80, lows around 50. Thanks for joining us for this morning's news. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson and Chris Andre. Our engineer and the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Jake Wallner.
And I'm Chris Andre.
coming up this morning on KBOO.